Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi there, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here at Heritage Radio Network. And today, I want to talk to you about something you're all very familiar with, but not in the way we're going to be speaking about it. Aunt Jemima. You all know the image. You've seen it a million times, whether it's on the box of pancake mix or other baked goods. A couple of centuries, or like 100 years, I would believe, this demeaning moniker and stereotype has maligned kitchen servants and cooks who, over two centuries, presented food to people that was never, never acknowledged. One woman is doing quite a bit to break that image and the stereotype, and that is Toni Tipton Martin. Toni is an author, a food journalist, and a community activist. She's the founder and director of the Sandy Youth Project at University of Texas at Austin. And she has done an amazing bit of outreach work on, particularly with youth, to help them live a more nutritional life. And in fact, she won a prize at the Southern Foodways Alliance, the John Edgerton Prize for this work. And with that prize, she was able to host a very important conference that just took place this past year, the Soul Summit, a conversation about race, identity, power, and food in Austin. And Toni has been working on a project to break this Jemima Code, as she calls it, for quite some time, something that's been going on for a lot longer than what she's been working on, and so important to her. This work has culminated in a new book called The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. And I am very pleased to have with me Toni now to talk about this and tell us all about this book and her upcoming book, The Joy of African-American Cooking. Welcome, Toni.
Thank you so much, for Linda. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, now, you were on with me I looked at the list of shows, and it was 3 years ago. I can't believe it was 3 years ago. And then we talked about your project, Breaking the Jemima Code. And I'm now that it's culminated into this wonderful book, tell our listeners what this project, what this book, how it started out, what it's all about.
Well, you did such a great job in your opening of explaining this idea of breaking a code. We all know that we live with codes of every kind around us. There are Morse codes. There are bar codes. The idea of a code is something that communicates a message from one person or group to another, right?
Right.
And so this idea that there is a Jemima code, for me, it really is this idea that actions, thoughts, behaviors, opinions are all crafted, generated out of this trademarked image that was built basically on a myth. It was built on a code, coded language, collecting various characteristics and aspects of African-American women in the kitchen into this one stereotyped symbol that can communicate different messages to different communities. So she means one thing to white people. She means something different to black people. She communicates across class lines. And so our idea with this book is that when you encounter the image on the cover right up front, you're asked subconsciously to think about what encoded messages you are sensing when you interact with this image.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it's interesting. When you said it, the image, of course, speaks different things to different people. And, you know, there's always the kind of the warm and fuzzy mammy who's sort of slapping together a comfort meal, you know, for a family. And that leads us into something that was really quite troubling to you and, well, to society as well. And what went amiss there?
Well, you know, scholars, feminist scholars, women's studies scholars, African-American scholars have been doing a lot more research in recent years into this idea of the nostalgia that created the mammy character in the first place. Right, she seems to have been, to some extent, a figment of literary imagination.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't to say that black women did not exist in the households of southern plantations. It's not to say that they didn't do a tremendous amount of work. It isn't to say any of those kinds of things that we all know and believe about them. But this idea that multiple characteristics existed and created this one superwoman, who was at one point very strong and nurturing and supportive, but then at other points in literature and history, she's portrayed as unintelligent and, you know, ignorant in some places. So there's been this continual confusion, if you will, in the minds of Americans about how to appreciate, to understand, to reject this woman, because those original creators who were trying to sell more pancake mix, I think if they did what most advertisers do, they tried to incorporate as many characteristics so she could appeal across a broad part of society.
Right.
She could appeal to numbers of people because they would have touched, created all these touchstones within her character. And I think that's part of why we're all so confused now about whether the image is important to keep. Should we reject it? Should we, you know, lobby Quaker to get rid of it? What, you know, what should we be doing with her now?
That's right.
And so my passion is that we should embrace her bandana and look at her for who they look at these women and some men for who they truly were in the performance of their duties.
That's right. And that's what I want to get to now, because you started what started your passion to for your collection and then this project on bringing to light some of the very accomplished African American cooks?
Well, you know, I am not a collector in the traditional sense. In fact, I'm a reluctant collector. I was really a reporter on a story. I was working for the Los Angeles Times in the food section, and I was very young, and I noticed pretty quickly that the images of African-American women, as they were portrayed in American cookbooks, whether they were from the South or the North, or any region, really, they were usually presented in some kind of a stereotyped fashion, if they were mentioned at all. Mm-hmm. They were generally some kind of an afterthought in terms of the creation of American cooking. And I was young, and that disturbed me. These images did not represent the kinds of women that I knew in my community that had nurtured and cared for all of us. But I didn't really know what I could do about it. I wasn't born in the South. I didn't have deep roots that traced to the South. So there wasn't anybody I could interview, right, and ask these questions that I had. And being a good reporter, I knew I needed somebody to talk to. And so cookbooks started to emerge for me as a possible way to hear the authentic, true voice of a person speaking on her own behalf. Mm. And even in the case where white women had to translate the books for these women, which is really quite a beautiful synergistic thing that did occur along the way. So I want to make sure that readers are aware that this is not, you know, this book is not an attack on broader communities that would have, in some ways, did disparage these people, but they're great souls along the way that we learn about too.
Right. Well, and finding some of these original voices was not an easy task because, as culinary historians knew for years, it was very difficult to find any written collections of recipes. What Mrs. Fisher knew, we know that book about Southern cooking. So you set about finding some of these voices, right?
I did. I was gifted with the first book. While I was at the Times on staff, we used to have a giveaway for books that were sent into the department for review. And in that collection, there was a book called The New Orleans Cookbook by Lena Richard. And at the time, I had no idea who Lena Richard was. There was no image of her, no photograph of her as being a black woman, but I thought, well, New Orleans cooking is close to what I'll be looking for, so I will hang on to this one for a while. And time passed, and the deeper my engagement with Southern Foodways Alliance and the appreciation for the diversity in Southern cooking, I got my strength and began to collect more in earnest, asking friends who traveled to check in bookstores, antique bookstores, and in secondhand stores, thrift shops. And over time, I started this teeny little collection of just a handful of books. And so it wasn't until the emergence of the Internet and the ability to search by browser that I was actually able to visit antique stores virtually because booksellers were then putting their inventory online. Mm-hmm. And I could use the University of Alabama's bibliography of these books as my shopping list.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I'm sure that many of these are. You did a wonderful visual exhibit, the photographs of all these, the covers of many of these books, and that was very stimulating because you could see that there was some of it were just they were little paper pamphlets, and some were very small books. Others were, as you say, helped along the way, you know, and published. And it just was such an eye-opener to what we didn't know. I think that's the best way that I can describe it, things that we didn't know that existed. And indeed, a lot of times these cooks were associated with, as you say, their poverty kitchens that they were often cooking in. But they also cooked in great kitchens, whether it was as slaves or as servants, with incredible availability of resources. And from that, and then they became very educated in the cooking. And so from that, you have opened our eyes to some of these very accomplished cooks. And tell us something, a little bit about that.
Sure. I love, and please apologize, I'm suffering from allergies a little bit here. I love the idea of being able to show the dexterity and the nimbleness of these cooks, right? These are people, as you said, who traditionally we know of as people who had to feed their families on very slim resources, whatever was given to them, whatever was left over. And then, of course, their ingenuity with what was in their natural environment, hunting and gathering, as we say. But there's an entirely different side of them, this idea of what it means to cook when you have infinite access to great, great ingredients and resources. Mm-hmm. And it is there that their intelligence just continues to bloom, because now we can see them as people who did not have the ability to read or write, and yet they managed within their memories this tremendous recall for hundreds of recipes, right? A household employer or mistress might read a recipe to this woman and explain to her the way that she wanted a dish, and then this woman had to remember that. She did not have the benefit that most of us have of just returning to the shelf and opening the book to refresh her memory. These women had to know how to do that on a regular basis. And so what I really like about the Jemima Code is that traditionally we have given African-American cooks a lot of attention and credit for what we call the soul foods, the foods that they cooked with their ingenuity and their imaginations and their creative style, and even with some reaching back to those African techniques that certainly would have been within their psyches and their memory. But here we're beginning to now see them for the food that they cook at work. And that's not a space that we've allowed them to enjoy intelligence in. We've kind of perceived them there as either unintelligent laborers who were just taking instruction, or we've thought of them as people cooking by natural instinct. And either way, it really has blocked all of us, whether we're black or white or low or high or middle income. Who wants to go into the kitchen if the perception that it is the place for slaving in the kitchen still exists? Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's so important to me and to us as a broader culinary community to inspire young people by helping them understand that their ancestors performed much greater accomplishments in the kitchen than just being the servant.
That's right. Well, how many of these books did you end up with total to sort of form the basis of your research for the book?
So I have about 300 of them, which is really sounds like a lot for me, but for us in terms of when we compare that to the 100,000 books that are published, cookbooks that are published at any given time, to have only 300 reflected in the African American canon is pretty small.
Right.
The University of Alabama, as I said, which is the holder of the greatest collection that I know of these books, they list about 450 on their site. And many of those are regional, right? They're books that I would never have access to because people in the area can bring over their community and church cookbooks.
Right.
There are some duplicates on that list as well. There are books that are perhaps in first, second, third edition, multiple editions. So when I talk about my 300, I'm speaking specifically of singular editions extracted from that bibliography at Alabama.
Interesting. And some just amazing stories. Well, first of all, what I like about it, too, and you mentioned that you weren't, when you found something, you had some of these antique booksellers, and I know you were just in New York this week, in fact, signing books at Bonnie Slotnick's, and she helped find a few of you. But you said a few of the books for you, and you said that you were not daunted by the fact that many had maybe grease stains on them or marks in the margins, which I'm sure you felt, and I know most of us who collect books know that makes them all the more endearing, right?
Absolutely. It certainly adds to their character, and it adds to their value, right? Because now these are books, these are recipes that we know have been tested and tried in the generation in which they were published, right? So I've been, as you mentioned, I spent the summer testing a great number of these recipes to modernize them for the next book, which we have. We were working with The Joy of African American Cooking as our working title, but we have moved on from that in large measure because of so much of the reaction that we're getting on the road with interest in this material and seeing the sense of freedom that has been created now by these authors and their ability to have a voice. And so the working title now for that book is Jubilee.
Oh, okay.
And we're thrilled with that idea. But yeah, the idea that they were gently used and worn really was part of what was endearing to me about them, because now I had an additional view into that community. The notes that were made where one cook might say very good next to a dish in her pencil, in her handwriting. And there's always open note pages, so we can also see their adaptations of a dish on those pages as well.
Well, I want to hear more specific stories about these, and I will get to that when we return after a short break. So stay with us.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
We are back, and I'm talking with Toni Tipton Martin about her new book, The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. And, you know, Toni, you were talking before about, we were talking about the cooks and when they had poorer ingredients than they had in the maybe grand houses, people, employers that they worked for, cooking what we know as soul food. And not always poor ingredients, some very excellent ingredients as well. But that there is a lingering stereotype with African-American cooks, and that is that they are only associated with cooking soul food. How are we going to break out of that one?
Well, that's really one of the main themes that emerges here in this collection of books. They form a natural social history once you spread them all out and look at them chronologically. And what is reflected here is clearly middle-class cooking, cooking with those very resources. And that's a part of our community that has not been explored very often. We do tend to be referred to as the great soul cooks, and as those invisible participants in the creation of Southern cooking. And so that distinction of trying to draw a racial line between ingredients is a challenge that I admit I was not even able to completely resolve. This idea that that we were talking about the food of a region, that region being the South, so Southern cooking, but looking at it as white or black, you know, it's a complicated story, and what I like to do is just focus primarily on the fact that these books reflect the effort of the ancestors to demonstrate what they were teaching one another about cooking with intelligence, so that in the 19th century, we see household servants who are training up one another, for example. That can be perceived negatively, as it has been, that that we were just limited to work of servitude and being trained continually in that effort. But if we look below the surface at what it took to do that job, then we can hear the character of the author as that author is explaining to the next generation how to get the work done and what they value, what their work ethic is, and the depth of knowledge that is communicated in that transmission, which would ordinarily be oral, but in these rare occasions, as in the case of Robert Roberts, for example, in 1827, we're able to see what he conveyed specifically to the next generation of servants. And that practice goes on throughout this collection. At the turn of the century, when freedmen's communities were building up what we now call historically black colleges and universities, those freedmen's schools were in the business of training more domestic servants and more household workers. But we're also able to see the level of science in their knowledge, right? These cooks might say, I'm going to put on a pot of beans, and what they were really doing was creating a stock. They just didn't have the language to convey that.
Right. Can you share with us, there are a couple books, I know some of the older books that have some rather poignant stories, as you've been talking about them, and as are in the book. There are a couple of older books that... maybe you could tell us a little bit, like Melinda Russell, or maybe, oh, the story. Well, Yeah, by Melinda Russell or Robert Roberts, as you just mentioned before. Some of those, what type of cooking were they doing that would be surprising to people when they read the book?
Well, they're doing the kind of cooking that we know that they were cooking, the households of the elite in the South. So it's largely Southern cooking, but it's elegant Southern cooking. It's the kind of food that's on a buffet table. It's they're banquet foods. But they're also foods that are regional, that reflect regionality, so that the Negro Culinary Arts Club of 1936 in Los Angeles, they're making the same kinds of elegant salads using lobster and higher-end ingredients or regional ingredients, like Ortega chilies in their dishes. And so what is going to be surprising to some people is the claiming of dishes that seem to contradict the idea of poverty cooking exclusively.
Right.
And this idea that that's not African American. And what I like to challenge people to think about is the fact that we celebrate amazing chefs today without knowing what it is that they cook at home. They're honored and respected for the food that they cook at work, in
That's
their
happening.
Restaurants, on their television shows. But we don't know whether they eat peanut butter and jelly or elaborate dishes at home with their children. And so that same philosophy has got to convey to African Americans as well. So I'm not claiming that we did anything necessarily different or grander than any other culture.
No.
What I'm saying is that we have not been allowed to exist within the space of ownership of the foods that we prepared professionally.
Right. No, you're absolutely right about what one is known for. However, in the case of the African American cooks, they sort of were the invisible people in the kitchen and rarely received credit for a lot of the dishes or recipes that they may have created. And that I think is something that, well, may be forever lost, but certainly with your book, you are bringing so much of that to light. And I think it's absolutely fascinating, some of these, the old pamphlet books especially. I mean, they're really, and you mentioned that, was it Frieda DeKnight was somebody who was an eye-opener for you in terms of the cooking of the black cooks around the country.
Yeah, what I like about Frieda DeKnight is that I relate to her. In fact, my work really parallels her work. In 1948, she was the food editor for Ebony Magazine, which was the magazine of the black middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And as their food editor, she bore a great deal of intelligence in home economics and domestic science. And what she did was she used that space as food in her food columns as a platform for the middle class and their cooking. And so when she created the book, A Date with a Dish, she recruited recipes, she aggregated recipes from cooks all over the country to demonstrate not only diversity of talent, but diversity of ingredient, regionality. And she explains quite clearly what her motive is. She wants to break the stereotype, and she says that in the 40s. So these are not people that didn't understand how they had been portrayed and the limits that were placed upon them. I think that she was clearly aware of the opportunity, as I am, that exists within the food industry for economic opportunity, once you're able to establish yourself, and our people were not able to do that. And so it seems really admirable to me that she took that on as her cause in producing this book of hundreds of recipes. This is not one of those pamphlets. This is a 600-some-page book with 3 to 4 recipes packed tight per page.
And you say, and it presents a regionality to gathered from all around. the country. That's great. Well, and it's not to, and the whole discussion too, not to, you know, the African American cook doing most of the cooking in the South, and then from which perhaps, you know, sprang the soul food, you know, as what we call soul food, even though it goes beyond. Not to malign soul food, because it's it's excellent and everybody loves to eat that, but to acknowledge, and this book does such a wonderful job, to acknowledge the richness and diversity of the cooking, as you say, with Frieda DeKnight's representation of all the regional differences of cooking that was going on, and also the food knowledge and, you know, and instructional expertise that I think goes far beyond what most people think of when they have that image of Aunt Jemima.
That is so true. And you know, the challenge has been representing this material in a way that is not perpetuating any further barriers between us culturally or by class, right? The idea that these cooks shared some of the very same qualities as their counterparts of other cultures is really an important thing to acknowledge without having to take that away from anyone else, right? They can exist on their own as being intelligent without that having to say, but you weren't, right? It this whole idea in Southern and Soul, like there's some taking away from one or the other. As Natalie Dupree has, you know, generously and beautifully articulated, that was the food of everyone in the South at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And how it became segregated is a matter for historians to study. I do make some brief discussion of it, but that's really not my focus here. I want to be able to explain that African American cooks cook with some of those same competencies. And this is a particularly sensitive topic for me because I have received already a couple of, you know, remarks about letters, frankly, of people saying, you know, why are you trying to claim that they did something that they didn't do? And, or that other people didn't do. And I am not suggesting that. What I'm saying is that we have not acknowledged that they cooked with an intelligence. I want to make sure that that is really clear, Linda, that they cooked with an intelligence just the way that others did. They learned on the job.
Mm-hmm.
They brought techniques with them from Africa so that while the rest of the world might have been cooking over an open fire and frying and baking in leaves and using nuts to thicken, we were doing that. And it isn't that somehow once we got on those slave ships and made that passage, we forgot all of that knowledge. Those people, as Karen Hess has said so beautifully as well, somehow that seeps into your practice. And any of your listeners, all of us that are cooks, know that you can give us both. You and I could stand side by side, right? And we could be given the same ingredients. And if I stir to the left and you stir to the right, we may come out with a very different dish.
That's right.
And your version will be known as your version, and my version will be known as my version. And all I'm suggesting is that in light of copyright protections, intellectual property law, all of these things that we haven't allowed to be applied to this group of people, that we should start to think of them in that way.
Well, your book is certainly a great contribution to that effort and to that study. And I thank you so much for joining me and sharing the information on this. And I urge people, if they, you know, it's a book that people should read because it's very interesting. Again, it is The Jemima Code, 2 Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. And in fact, as one someone, a Facebook follower, when I mentioned that you were going to be on the show, she said, I have to have this book in my life. So it's something that I think that is going to make a tremendous impact, and good luck to you. And I look forward to Jubilee. That's the book that I'm going to look forward to getting next when you, as a culmination of all this. And I thank you for sticking with this because it is such an important project and such an important book. Thanks so much, Toni Tipton Martin.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda. I really appreciate it.
That's my pleasure. And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And I'd like to thank my engineer, Liz Smith. Today's break music was provided by the Soulful Saints. And the theme song to my show was created by Bohemia. Our sponsor today I would like to thank is Fairway Market. Also, thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please tell your friends to tune in, too, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. And feel free to get in touch with us at heritageradionetwork.org. And if you are really an avid listener and love what you hear, on our homepage, there is an easy way that you can help us out, and it's a donate button. Just click that button, and you can help support this program and so many others that appear on this network, that you can hear on this network. And next up, you're going to hear a short clip of The Speakeasy, another great show found right here on Heritage Radio Network.
Well, first of all, fall is my favorite season
for
cocktails. And it's just, like you said, you know, it's during harvest season, you've got all this beautiful, beautiful produce and different, like everything. Everything's happening during, like, the end of the summer and early fall.
On episode 137 of The Speakeasy, master bartender Aaron Polsky talks to host Damon Bolte on why fall is such a perfect time to make great cocktails.
There are just new ingredients that are available to us in general, you know, and that's great. Like, the accessibility and availability of spices and good quality produce on the wholesale level is awesome. And also the technology to make them work fast. So everybody, well, not everybody, but you and I know the Dave Arnold pioneered rapid infusion technique with an EC container. And of course you can do that with a cryovac, or as I recently discovered, a food saver with a handy food saver Tupperware canister attachment. You can make things work fast. You can experiment quickly. You can weigh things in grams. You can time how long it takes, how long you're putting suction on it. And you can get really good bitters, good infusions. And that's great in, you know, especially for the fall, because you think of fall, you think of, I mean, all jokes aside, you do think of pumpkin spice. You think of pumpkin pie, and you think of all those warm spices and squash and all that.
Apples,
pears, pumpkin spice.
Yeah.
I think that six years ago, it would have been difficult to find different types of cinnamon, and now you can easily get them.
Whether you know what a rapid infusion machine is, or you're a bartending novice, be sure to listen to The Speakeasy, available on Heritage Radio Network and iTunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.